You're listening to Two Guys Talking Wine with Michael Pincus and Andre Prue.
It's not often that we're recording in a construction zone.
No, it doesn't happen very often, that's for sure. Usually there's a baby screaming in the background, but not a construction zone.
I mean, I was trying to find some clever way to either call you a baby or mea culpa baby, but I'm just tired today.
It's been that kind of weekend. Andre,
has been that
how
kind
are
of weekend.
You?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm good. I thought we'd start off the podcast this week with a funny little wine that was dropped off at my door. This is, it's now in the LCBO, which kind of leads us into your major topic today. But this is a Finca Feliz Tesoro Criolla. And I thought it was just one of those, as the Italians call it, fantasy name. But it turns out Criolla is a grape that is similar to Pais, which we had talked about when you were in Chile.
Yeah, that's one of the grapes that stood out to me while I was there. And it's something I found fascinating because we actually have a few topics that we're going to be touching on. Like the whole concept of natural wine and like what's happening in Chile is it's just like, it was fascinating to see in Chile because of how much corporate ownership there is in their wine production, to see some people trying to reclaim some of the original grapes that arrived in Chile, and that's part of the natural wine movement down there. This is interesting.
So the Criolla, it turns out, it's actually Criolla Grande, and it's the third most, as of 2006, that was the most recent numbers I could get. It is the third most planted grape in Argentina, obviously behind Malbec. And then there's a grape called Cereza. So, but
is this concrete or stainless steel?
It's it says here that it's all concrete vats. And it's supposed to be like one of those fresh, fruity wines that you're supposed to just kind of sit out on the deck and enjoy. It's 12-year-old vines, although from what my understanding is, a lot of the, and that's really young for this grape, because most of the ones are 40-plus years old. So this is a very young version of it. I think it's fresh. It's definitely fruity.
It's got an earthiness to it, but it's, like I said, it's not too heavy. It's, I think it's not bad.
It says sugar content of 2. I don't know what that means.
It's bone dry.
So
I'm guessing it's 2 grams per liter.
That's what I would have thought as well, but, it's aged 5 months in concrete. That's a quite an interesting little fun little wine.
I did call it as concrete.
Yeah. So, yeah, there you have it.
It smells like candied cherry. I mean, this is, like, Gamay-esque, but, like, it's missing a lot of the, like, core flavors of Gamay. It's not as rustic as some of the Italian, like, indigenous varieties. I think it's cool when we see wines coming out of Argentina that aren't just Malbec or Cabernet.
Yeah.
Like, and because, you know, as we mentioned with the cousin of Pais, like, that was one of the exciting things about Chile is to see indigenous, I say indigenous in air quotes because like these grapes were all imported
via Spain from what I read about them. But this I think Finca Feliz is a little wrong on their tasting note. They say it's their version of Pinot Noir, and I think they're wrong on that. I think this is Gamay.
Yeah, it's definitely got a rusticness to it than.
It's more fresh and fruity than it is Pinot-esque, I would go.
Yep. And you said it's available at the LCBO.
It is. So it's $20 or something like that. So
man, I've had an interesting like few weeks where like the LCBO has really pissed me off as a consumer, and especially as a consumer now who is spending more money on premium wines, like we've talked about on the podcast, like since leaving radio, I'm making a little bit more money, and I like to spend that money on wine. And we've talked a lot about how the LCBO is not doing a great job serving the wine-loving audience of the province.
They're doing a terrible job, and you know, as you know, I do wine tours, and I want the LCBO to know that consumers are noticing. Like, if you bring it up, people are like, yeah, I'm noticing that I'm not getting the kind of selection at the LCBO I used to get.
So last month on Instagram, I did my monthly Cellar It with Maroki. We tasted a really great New Zealand Pinot Noir, and I said that it felt more like a Côte d'Henri Burgundy, a little bit heavier, a little bit broader in the shoulders, a little bit more muscular. And Maroki said, oh, I've never had like a Côte d'Henri Burgundy, so I don't have anything to compare it to. And I said, you know what, like, let me spring for a nice bottle so that we can at least work on, like, let's do this for education purposes. I went to the LCBO website, and it's just, imagine me, I'm typing away, and it's like, oh, amazing. They have a Rush de Belen, and we've interviewed Nico Patel on this podcast before, one of our fantastic guests.
Friend of the podcast.
I guess we could say that. The website said he had a 2017 Nuit Saint-Georges for $77. I'm like, hell yeah. A Pinot that's got a little bit of age to it, like not super old, but like at the point where like the tannin should be soft. And like, I was excited to get this for my friend that I wanted to talk about Burgundy with and go to the LCBO to pick it up. Because when you live in Hamilton, or as you know, living in St. Catharines, you don't have Summerhill or head office at the end of the street. You got to order and do pickup. And it's a little bit of a like making sure you line things up, going out of your way to get choice bottles.
Yep.
Pick up the bottle. It's a 2020.
Yeah, that's kind of a letdown.
And that's it. It's just like, that would be the equivalent of you and me like getting the brochure for 2024 Honda Civic. Being so excited to go test drive the new Honda Civic and showing up at the dealership. And they're just like, well, we've got the 2019. That's what you get. The same car, right?
Well, I mean, you know, I remember years ago learning about bait and switch. So, and it's illegal in Ontario, and yet the LCBO has nobody holding their feet to the fire.
No, okay,
about these kind of things.
So one time, the first time this happened to me, I was just like, okay, not a huge deal. Someone must have messed up. It must have been like a clerical error or something. I still get the vintages catalog mailed to me every month.
Yep.
I don't buy a lot of vintages these days. I'm spending more money ordering from agents direct because they serve me better than the LCBO. But I was really excited. The Lanson Champagne from the Marc Anthony tasting.
The rosé was great.
I thought the entire lineup of champagne was great. I went and immediately after that tasting bought two bottles of the 2009 vintage champagne, because I thought that was good and had some legs to age a little bit longer. My wife and I drank one, and then the second one's in the cellar. The front page of the catalog, the 2012 vintage, I'm like, oh boy, like, let's get a partner for my 09 in the cellar so we can do like a really nice like champagne night in the future. Go to my LCBO app, punch it in, go out of my way. I have to drive to Burlington, like a half hour from my house, show up at the store to pick it up. It's the 09 vintage that's on the shelf of the LCBO.
Yeah, see, and there's nobody holding them. There's nobody holding them accountable for any of this.
And that is
bait and switch. And what are you going to do? Like, are you going to take it back? Are you going to? Who do you complain to?
I made the trip. Like, I was actually planning on buying two bottles. I bought one bottle that we drank with some friends, but it was just like cork bottles are a part of life. Like, the cork bottles don't bother me when I open a cork bottle. Like, it's just a part of being a wine collector. The thing I've long said is the worst part of being a wine lover is when you feel ripped off. And the thing is, I'm feeling cheated by the LCBO. Like I get it. It's the same producer and it's the same wine, but
no,
it's not the same wine.
It's not
the same
wine.
The vintage matters.
Absolutely. Absolutely the vintage matters. And again, I have to stress it. We have got to start really asking better from the LCBO, and they're not giving it to us. They don't care. They're the only game in town. So you get there and you say, hey, this was supposed to be the 12, and they go, oh, well, sorry, you want to leave it? Well, you know,
I drove a half hour to get here, right?
You know, what do I do now? You know, you've just lied to me, and it's not like somebody phones you up and says, hey, we see you've ordered the 12. We want to let you know that it is the 9.
I mean, it's the thing, too, is...
Because most of the people that work there are just... They don't care. But they don't realize.
It's also like if I were working at the LCBO, like you're being set up for a certain amount of failure on that side too, right? Like, I don't know. You should give craps about this. If you're going to feature it on the front page of your stupid little catalog, make sure the product's available and at least make sure that this the LCBO code matches up with what the product is on the front page of that stupid catalog.
On the other hand, maybe the code just does match up because they use the same code every year and somebody just yanked the 9. Maybe there's some 12 kicking around. You just don't know. Again, it's just people not paying attention. And again, you can't hold them accountable because nobody's going to get fired over it. Nobody cares. Selection is down. I go back to David Laurison's comment at one point in the last year where he said the LCBO is spending our money and nobody is keeping account of what they're doing. They have stopped journalists from going in and tasting the wine and saying, yes, these were good wines that they brought in or these are bad wines they brought in. There is just nobody doing that because there's, again, nobody holding them to account. And when Ford says, I'm going to start changing the LCBO, I applaud him. And, you know, I really wish the union would just give it up already. Like, let the private sector take over and the LCBO
let the LCBO sell Yellowtail and the Post Malone
and
wine.
All the big brands that they want.
Just imagine Summerhill could just be completely replaced with celebrity wines and they would probably still be printing money. And you know what? Like, let's let people like Carrie Dearborn with her little agency open up her own store. Let Rogers and Company open up a shop in Oakville, Burlington, and Toronto. Correct. So we can get our Ridge Montebello and
your profiles, you know, the largest Lifford could open up a number of stores. You know, let this happen already. It is goddamn time that it happens.
Language.
I'm just so tired of the LCBO. I remember when you'd walk into the LCBO and they had 3 facings of wine. Now they got 6. The selection is terrible. George Solais is the worst thing to happen to the LCBO.
Well, since the LCBO existed. So, I guess moving on here, you and I, we were looking for stuff to talk because we didn't want to do another like Shooting the Breeze podcast like we did last episode. Although I did get some good feedback from people about the last episode sliding into my DMs. So thank you for the people who enjoyed last one. What the hell is going on at Quench Magazine? Like, I used to really, like, I loved writing for Quench. I feel like one of the things I'm most proud of as a wine writer is writing the cover story about Quebec wine. Because I really feel, like, not to pat myself on the back, but, like, I caught on to something before it's even happened. I still don't even think Quebec wine has really had its day yet.
I don't think it. I think Quebec wine is one of the things that's never going to hit, but it's nice to see it on the cover. I know I made a couple of covers of Quench. I was real, but they've gone from what 10 times a year to 2 times a year,
and even then, it's just like I remember listening. So it's Gurvinder,
yeah,
Badia, who's now like the editor in chief, and I was on a trip with him, and I listened to him talk about that. He's trying to make the magazine appeal to a broader audience, and like I'm taking a look at the content that's in this magazine. How far out of touch can you be for a wine magazine? Like, for one, I'm taking a look at their wine content on their website right now. And there's a specific article I want to talk about with you. But from February 25th, the rise of bottle shops in Ontario. Like, bottle shops hit the scene out of necessity in the pandemic in 2020. But we're already at the point where we're seeing bottle shops close.
Yeah, I don't think
because the model is, like, there is no rise of the bottle shop. Peter Pantry closed. And that was a well-to-do bottle. That was a bottle shop with bottles I was going to spend money at. We have Endless Wine here in Hamilton up the street, which was serving the natural wine crowd in this city. And, like, a really cool vibe. That place has closed. Bottle shops are not rising.
No.
Bottle shops are closing.
Which is why the Ford government has got to speed up the privatization in this province.
But like, I don't know, if you're a magazine that's supposed to be serving an audience, like, what are you doing talking about the rise of bottle shop 4 years after the pandemic? Like, it's just embarrassing from a magazine that used to do a really great job prominently featuring Ontario, prominently featuring what was new and cool in Ontario, prominently featuring what is cool and new other places.
In Canada as well, although it was primarily an Ontario-focused magazine at some point, and then they started to broaden out as the other magazines, Vines and Wine Access, closed, because Wine Access is the only magazine, wine magazine in Canada these days. And again, I would, well, National Wine Magazine.
Yep.
And I, again, would like to say that it is due in part to the LCBO and the BCLDB or whatever the heck they are.
Oh, yeah, I mean, it's
like
it's
they've
even
all got these magazines that they're charging, you know, huge prices for advertising. Since when did the government start competing with private enterprises to get magazines off the shelves?
Well, they're not magazines, they're catalogs. Can we please stop calling them?
They are catalogs. I get that. But, you know, you're charging them, I don't know, you know, last I heard it was $10,000 a page. I'm sure it's much more than that.
Well, the
now.
Circulation is insane. Like, when you have no one competing against you and you can give it away for free. Like,
correct.
That's not a business. Like, that is, anyways. There was an article in particular I thought would be fun to talk about, because I think it's almost a little bit ironic. The headline, and it's an article from last October, by the way. Is natural wine dead? Which I thought was amusing, because now that I think we're starting to see a little bit of the death of the faulted dirty hippie water.
Orange wines sold. And yeah.
No, but we can't lump orange wines in here. But like, there's just a paragraph that I highlighted from this article that I thought might be fun to kick around, because like our first interview of the year was with a natural wine producer.
Correct. Yeah.
But it's irrelevant that his wines are natural to you and I, because the wines are good.
I didn't know he was a natural wine producer until after I tasted his wines, and they didn't taste, you know, in that natural vein. Let's go.
All right. So there's a paragraph in this article that I thought stood out that I thought would be a good launching point for us to have a quick conversation. For those of us who have insisted on wine made solely from organic grapes, the fact that the natural wine craze achieves so much acclaim is worth celebrating. Here's the thing, and this is a problem with the wine industry in general. I'm going to add my little commentary as we go through this. It never achieved wide acclaim.
No.
It achieved cult status with a bunch of people who got into an echo chamber and patted each other on the back.
Yep.
That's it. It never reached like wide acclaim.
Yep.
Others should take note that it wasn't actually a craze, but a shift that made considerable contributions to the greater Venice world. I think there is an argument to be made that some of the practices from the natural wine world have been taken notice, but I think the industry was heading that direction. Anyways, like them or not, the natural contingent was the driving force around reclamation of abandoned vineyards and regions like Chile and Georgia, the country, not the state. Okay, that's definitely true from what I saw in Chile. Many growers left chemical farming behind in favor of organic, regenerative, or biodynamic farming, acceptance of hybrid grapes, and naturally low alcohols. New oak is mostly on the decline as producers explore alternative fermentation vessels that have less impact on taste, concrete, clay, old wood, and glass. I saw this happening well before the natural wine movement was taking hold.
Correct. Yep.
So, like, this is the natural wine movement, and someone, the author who's a fan of the natural wine movement, patting themselves on the back. Even in conservative regions like Bordeaux or Burgundy, producers are reevaluating additives, including reducing the sulfur additions. Legacy producers like Domaine de Monti and Albert Bichot have added some natural, organic, and no SO2 wines to their lineup. Then there's the Pet Nat and Skin Contact wines.
Yeah.
Now, and I write this with relief, it's far easier for me to grab a glass of natural wine almost anywhere I go. This category to a style of wine that is fizzy, cloudy, and boring, with no structure, soulless, with wildness filtered out, but easy to drink, they were just as formulaic as the parkerized wines of the past. That last sentence really stuck out to me when we talk about the parkerization really creating a standard flavor profile, especially in Bordeaux and in California. I think the natural wine movement has done the same thing. And it's something I've noticed, like working at farmers markets, when I talk to someone who's a natural wine fan coming up and taking a look at what we're selling, and I ask them what they like, is we have a young generation of sommeliers whose palates are calibrated to enjoy faults now.
Yeah, I think we kind of touched on this a few weeks back, and I really wish we would get away from the faulty wines that seem to permeate sommeliers' lists. I I'm getting so tired of hearing about natural wine, about organic wine. Unless you're, you know, I remember talking to the winemaker of Yolamba, who said to me, and this was years ago, like absolutely, it's got to be about 10 years ago. She was in town. They were talking about their wines, and they said, you know what? We are a large company, and we want to be as natural and as organic. Even those words at that time were being used and thrown around. We are trying to be as natural and as organic and pesticide-free as we possibly can, and we do not use them. But, here's the but. If we are in fear of losing the crop because something we are going to spray, and like it or not, you've got to think that a large company like that is, they employ a lot of people. There's jobs on the line. You can't just let that many acres go and say, nope, we're not making wine this year.
Yeah.
Like at some point, you've got to make a business decision. And I totally get that.
Well, the business decision aside, like for me, it's almost like farcical to really, really crap on natural farmers who are trying to grow ultra premium fruit. And I'm talking especially in Niagara, you know, people like the Wismer family, the Grimsby Hillside folks, the Wilms family that, you know, we've been working with the ADX Wine Company. These are people who they have a vested interest in making sure their vineyards come back every year.
Correct. But have you ever asked what happens if it looks like you're going to lose this crop unless you put some spray to it? Do they go, nope, we're going to lose the crop? Or do they go, we're going to put some spray to this?
But it's the other side of the coin as well, is that spray is money. No farmer in Niagara is willy-nilly with the sprays.
I got it.
Like nobody wants to be like, you know what, Michael? It's a hot, dry summer like 2020. You know what I'm going to do today? I'm going to go spray a bunch of shit in my vineyard.
Correct.
Because it's fun.
You don't want to do that. Like I remember talking to Adnan Isel of iSellers. And he had literally just gone out and sprayed his organic sprays, and it rained the next day. He was like, it was a waste of money. It said it wasn't going to rain. He went out and sprayed what he needed to spray, and it just got washed away. And he was lamenting the fact that stuff is not cheap.
I guess going back to, is natural wine dead? I do like that I'm starting to see the conversation take place more and more that the faulted natural wine movement, this attraction for wines that are made in a dogmatic style because they're unique and they're funky. And for me, it's kind of like, I think for the millennial generation, like we gravitated to New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc and Argentinian Malbec because they were easy. They stood out in terms of like the back label says it tastes like what it tastes like. So it was a foothold to get into the wine world. I think the natural wine movement did the same thing for the next generation, where it's just like this, you know, Black Ball Riesling from Pearl Morris that tastes like no other Riesling in the province.
But again, that didn't tell you anything about what it tasted like. And that was I think that was the problem with the Black Ball Riesling. And I think that's the biggest problem that we have in Ontario, is that we didn't let him just make his Riesling and let the market decide whether they wanted to buy it or not. If he didn't have that marketing behind it, Black Ball Riesling, taste the wine that's not supposed to be on the market, then who knows whether he would have sold out on that. Because you do have people who want to try that wine or is going to go buy that wine. And if you're somebody like Pearl Morissette, maybe you're not tasting that wine at the counter because maybe you know that it's faulted, and if people get the chance to taste it, they're not going to buy it. But if you tell them it's unique and that they got to buy it sight unseen, then lo and behold, people are going to buy it. That's what's going to make things sell out, because you got some sort of cachet behind it. I think the VQA should have just gone, all right, it's Ontario grapes, great. Signed off on it. Call it what you will.
All right, all right, all right. So just focus here, because I'm sure we'll talk about VQA at some other point. Let me just ask you, like, point blank then, is natural wine dead? Or is it dying?
You know what? It's not dead. I think the word's got to die. I think this labeling of them should go away, because there's a lot of confusion. What's natural? What's organic? Blah blah blah.
Marketing buzzwords, man.
That's exactly what they are.
Okay, so listen. I want to see if you agree with.
On the other hand, I'm just going to point out this, as I may have mentioned this to you before, that when I was in Cyprus, one of the winemakers, and I think we're going to have him on the podcast coming up. We're just waiting for the wines to arrive from Cyprus. But what he said was he got away from using organic, sustainable, natural, and what he started going with was vegan. And that was he was getting more sales off of the wines being vegan than he was getting them off of natural, sustainable, organic. They had done some research on it, and he was like, these are words that are, lost in the ether, lost in people's minds.
Yeah.
Whereas vegan, there are vegans out there who are like, yep, that's what I want in my wine.
Yeah, so the ADX Wine Company, we made the choice a few years ago to go vegan. We don't, fly a banner or anything that says it, but I have found people are responsive to that. And it wasn't a difficult choice. I went to Adam, our winemaker, and I was just like, listen, we've had a few restaurants ask about vegan options. And I don't know, as we said, I'm a meat eater on this, but, I'm a big fan of eating more vegetables and just making right choices for the environment. So it's something I'm proud of. But with regard to the rest of the winemaking process, there is a lot of just marketing tossed around.
I believe when it comes to natural, organic, sustainable, it's a lot of buzzwords. A lot of people get confused. They don't understand what it means. And they all mean the same damn thing.
So the last thing I wanted to talk to you about is Chris Waters recently wrote in the Globe and Mail, and I thought this was really great, because Chris is truly the last authority in broadsheet. He's the last wine writer in a newspaper that is not...
has credibility, I would think.
I guess, yep. In a national newspaper, there's some smaller wine writers, regionality, but Chris is doing great work at the Globe.
Yeah.
And he's got a challenging job to do to write nationally because of how fractured the wine industry is across the country. But he had this headline, Riesling is desperately seeking street cred. And I really love that. I love that because you and I, we've been jumping up and down talking about Riesling in one way, shape, or form since we've started this podcast. And we know that Ontario Riesling is great. And every time we get a bottle of Flat Rock to our house and you and I get together on a summer day, it doesn't take us long to drink a bottle of Flat Rock Riesling.
So Riesling is that grape that always says it's having its day and it never has its day.
No.
When Riesling had its day was in the 70s. Maybe in the early 80s, when in Ontario you were either black or blue. You were Black Tower or Blue Nun. That's when everybody was drinking Riesling. I think we've all moved on from Riesling. And, when you get to taste a good Riesling, you go, yep, I really like that. But I don't think Riesling needs street cred anymore. We all know it's good. People know it's good. When they taste it, they know it's good.
I think we just need to accept that Riesling is going to be Rush. It's going to be the band that smart people listen to. It's prog rock. It's the prog rock of the wine world. I think the quality of Riesling in general with the stuff that's coming in the market is getting a bit better. I don't think we have a generation of wine drinkers that are reaching for Black Tower or Blue Nun.
No, I don't think that's the case anymore. But I don't think anybody's reaching for Riesling anymore either.
No, but some people are. Rush sold out Rio, and Rush had a few albums that did pretty well, but not everybody is a Rush fan, right? And Rush is pretty divisive.
I don't know if Rush is divisive anymore.
Rush is completely divisive.
I like him.
Rush is one of those fans where,
I'm not a lover of Rush.
But that's it. The lovers of Rush can get pretty annoying.
And so you're saying that the lovers of Riesling can get pretty annoying?
Like the old adage of Cinderella, if the shoe fits. But since we were talking a bit about Riesling, because there was nothing super new, earth-shattering, or groundbreaking written in Chris's article. It's a lot of stuff that you and I had said, but if anything, I just always find it validating when Chris is on the same page as two guys talking wine, because let's face it, Chris is definitely more sophisticated than us.
A little bit.
But I had a couple bottles of New York Riesling that were kicking around my basement.
Yeah.
I have this Dr. Constantin Frank, 2021, specifies dry Riesling from the Finger Lakes.
I would give it that. It was definitely dry.
Then this...
Not bone dry, but yeah, dry.
This 2020 Forge Cellars Seneca Lake dry Riesling. I've been to Forge Cellars before, and I remember the wines being good, not great. The thing that kind of sucks about the Finger Lakes is, in U.S. dollars, I don't think these wines are terribly expensive. It's just the exchange that kills it.
Yeah.
Like if you go to the winery and it's like a $20 dry Riesling, like after the exchange, like that becomes a $30 bottle, right?
This is... the Constantin Frank is definitely a dry sipping wine. This Forge is not doing it for me. There's a strange kind of aftertaste that's kind of...
It almost tastes like it's oaked.
Throwing me off a little bit, and I'm not...
This wine almost tastes like it's got an oak finish.
And I'm not happy with it. And then you have this Chardonnay on the table that I was going to open, and then you didn't want me to try some...
Well, because the article's about Riesling. We're not doing Shooting the Breeze. We're doing like a nice focus here.
Yeah, but wouldn't you
like... Not another splash of the Constantin Frank.
Wouldn't you like to know whether Chardonnay is the grape of...
Oh, you're such a turd. All right, let's open the Chardonnay.
So
let's take a look at... I just want to take a look at the
wine.
And then
I got a surprise for you right at the end here. So, so let's you see if Chardonnay from New York is everything that it should be cracked up to be, or...
Oh, here we got the tech sheet for the 2020 dry Riesling from Forge Cellars. Interesting choice of bottle with the Burgundy bottle. Is this the right one? 12.5%?
Not totally.
Yeah, 12.5% alcohol. Yeah, there's not a lot of details on the actual winemaking on this sheet. Harvest date, October 14th to October 28th. 3.1 grams of residual sugar in the Forge Cellars. No, the Constantin Frank for 2021 was better, and that would have been a cooler year with higher acid.
I also liked it better. I thought that was the kind of one that you would sip on. The Forge, the more I sipped on it, the more of that funky flavors came out of the end, and I was like, I don't know if I'm all that happy with it. I probably would be in search of something else.
Yeah, I'm thinking in April I might head down to the Finger Lakes for a weekend just to get out of town. I've been working way too much.
And as far as the Lamoloro Landing, which is, I remember when I went there, and I was happy with their Chardonnay.
Whoa, the Dr. Constantin Frank is an $18 bottle of wine at the winery in the United States. I would drink the crap out of that for $18.99 US if I was getting paid in American dollars, but I'm not getting paid in American dollars. I'm getting paid in Canadian dollars. So that makes it like a $26 bottle.
Yeah, 25, 26. Yeah, the Lamoureux Landing a little bit on the sweeter side. It is a 2020. So a hot vintage, I'm assuming there. They're not that far from where we are. That's definitely a chill and enjoy kind of Chardonnay.
I don't think there's any like residual sugar in this. I think it is just phenolic.
I think there's a lot of fruit. There's a lot of peach and apple.
Lamoureux Landing. Let's take a look here. Well, we've covered a lot of ground. This has turned into a pretty long podcast. We've talked a bit about Riesling. Man, I'm still just like annoyed at the especially to treat like your premium customers like that. Like if you're making all your wines like a classic or essentials, and like to just don't put the vintage as part of the listing.
Again, I'm going to go back to it. The LCBO doesn't care. They continue to make money. They don't care. Period. The end. They don't care. They don't care about you. Go buy your wine. Shut up. You know, pay for it and get out of the store. That's kind of what they are. They have no customer service in many of the stores that I go to. It's just.
This Unoak Chardonnay is $15 US.
And when I go in there and I say, by the way, I see you have a few bottles of this. Can you help me find it? They're hunting and pecking just like I am. So what's the point of having them there? Yeah. They don't know where anything is. So
All right. Oh, yeah, we got one last wine to taste.
So I brought this along. I thought this would be kind of cool. Way back when we would go to, for those longtime listeners of the podcast, or if you haven't listened to the podcast before, I tell you to go back when we went to Saguenay, Quebec. We did it 2 years in a row, and we did some interviews. And then 1 year, Beaujolais was the sponsor of the Saguenay wine event. And you introduced me to Dominique Piron, which has become slowly but surely my favorite Beaujolais producer. Every time I see some, I try to pick it up if I'm in Quebec because it's usually on
you
the shelves.
I'm going to go out and say it's my favorite producer as well. Not in terms of like the best, because there's a few producers I've had where like they just knock your socks off. Like Chateau Thivin is a producer I love, but like QPR. Price to value?
Yeah. This is a Cheruble from 2015.
Oh, is it organic, Michael? Is it biodynamic?
Probably.
Is it
natural?
Is it natural?
Is it vegan? I have no idea.
Is it made with any sort of witchcraft or magic?
Yes, I believe that Dominique Piron does use witchcraft and magic for sure.
I've met Dominique Piron. He doesn't look like a witch.
You never know.
Or a warlock.
Whatever it is. But this is the original bottle that we bought while we were there. So this is a 2015. This, I think, is the last one I bought because I remember buying six or eight. They were like $16. Because I think they were on sale. Because
okay, just pour the wine. This podcast is going long.
All right, so here we are. Let's see.
Oh, color's nice. Oh, my God.
It's a Cheruble 2015 Dominique Piron.
Oh, it's starting to get a little bricky.
We are looking at... it's getting a little long in the tooth.
This is long in the tooth.
Hold on.
This is annoying because your cellar is actually like proper cellar. Have you been tooting on the corks?
Do you know what?
That is not good.
Do you know what? Let's let it open for a bit. Obviously, people won't be around when they find out. But I think I would not be surprised if that opens a little bit better. You'd be cranky, too, if you were stuck in a bottle for 9 years. That's what I think. It's a little cranky right now, but I want to give it the...
No, this is leather-bound books, dried fruit. This has no redeeming qualities left to it. You like old wine, though. I don't.
I think give me a bigger glass. We may be pleasantly surprised.
Okay, my favorite wine that we've opened is the Constantin Frank Dry Riesling. The Lamoureux Landing, it actually is a little higher in RS than I thought. I thought it was phenolic ripeness, so I think that's a testament to the winemaking, because that's at like 7 grams per liter residual sugar.
Yeah, I thought there was a little bit of sweetness to it. I didn't mind that Fink Feliz. I thought that was kind of fun. If you are looking for something that's a little bit different, something for the patio this summer, it's definitely a wine that you could stick on ice and really, really enjoy, because it was really, really light in color. So I'd recommend that. I think I may enjoy this Cheruble. We'll find out.
You will. I won't. I can guarantee that.
That's too bad.
I'm Andre Prue at Andre Wine Review. AndreWineReview.ca, which has not been updated in a while. I apologize for that. I'll work on that. I'll do better.
And I've moved some of our older podcasts over to YouTube if you're looking for another way to see us.
Nobody listening to this is going to switch to YouTube. They're already subscribed. You need to find new people.
Well, we have been finding some new people, and that's really nice. So I'm glad if you're new. If you're new and you're listening to us on YouTube.
I'm sorry. If you're new, I'm sorry. I'm sorry for what you've signed up for.
But I think you're going to enjoy it.
Sometimes.
Most times. Sometimes. I'm Michael Pincus of MichaelPincusWineReview.com. You can find me as The Grape Guy on most social media. Michael Pincus on Facebook. Good night.
Thanks for listening. Please subscribe to Two Guys Talking Wine on iTunes. Two Guys Talking Wine is produced by Jim Ray, Adam Duran, and Ken Little.